You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Introducing the two-way V4, where groundbreaking fuel cell technology meets fresh foam cushioning for the ultimate performance. With fuel cell, each step feels explosive, delivering unparalleled energy return. Paired with fresh foam, experience maximum comfort throughout the game. Its lightweight textile upper offers support and breathability without sacrificing agility. Whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the two-way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the two-way for yourself at newbalance.com.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Brocast. I am, in fact, David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network, and I am joined on this fine post-Thanksgiving, this blackest of Black Fridays, but never when I'm with you, Tracy Pearson. Tracy, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. How are you? That welcome kind of scared me.
Yeah, I bet.
Wow, that sounded like we were going into like a slasher movie.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Do you have a little,
I have some gravel in my voice.
Yeah, you picked that up in Hawaii, did you?
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, the transition back to these dry climes.
Yeah.
After being in the humid paradise of Hawaii, of Oahu.
Did you have
Honolulu.
Fun?
I did.
Dave brought his daughters, which.
I brought my children.
And this is the first time you'd ever been away, correct?
First time I'd been, first time they'd been.
Aww.
So they had a blast. They didn't want to leave.
That's so fun.
But like we did a little bit of the stuff, but like what they didn't want to leave was basically the pool. And being at the pool like for 6 hours a day.
Did they actually go in the ocean?
Yeah, they sure did. They sure did.
Okay,
good. Yeah, we did the. So we were at the Marriott where the team was staying, which was basically right across the street from the beach. So they spent like most of like two or three entire mornings just at the beach, just, you know, farting around, doing the whole thing. Like we were in the little like waiting beach for a lot of it where they had like a wave break and there were just schools of fish swimming around in there.
Oh,
and
one of my kids
was just chasing the school of fish the entire time. It was a lot of fun.
That's fun. Did you see Mick out at the pool? Mick Cronin?
No.
Darren Savino?
I saw Savino out at the pool. Or out at the pool bar, working on some I think it was the pre-scout from Marquette.
Did you say hello?
Yeah, I just waved to him.
Oh,
he was
that's
busy.
Fun.
He was doing his thing.
Yeah, he's doing his thing. Was he in like a Hawaiian shirt?
No, he was wearing his UCLA polo.
You're not doing anything for this visual for me.
No, it was
big board shorts.
No. Just he was Darren Savino in the wild. That's all it was. Mm. But no, the entire team was there. So like every time I was going down to the pool, which was like frequent during the day, the team was always like just like filing into the other part of the pool area because that was where they set up their like buffet meals and everything.
Oh wow.
Okay. Yeah, so my kids were constantly in the elevator. So it was Purdue and UCLA that were staying there. So my kids were constantly going into the elevator, and like frequently it was either Adai Mara or Zach Edey in the elevator with them. So they're just like looking up at like a 7'4" guy just constantly. And it was
how can he get in one of those elevators? He's bent over, right?
Hunched. Yeah. And so like Adai, I had a brief glimpse of what it's like to be him because, you know, getting in the elevator and then there's these like touristy types. I think it was like maybe some Purdue fans or something. They just immediately ask him, don't even say hello.
How tall are you?
And you could just hear him like the like soul death a little bit. And he's just like 7'3".
7'3".
Yeah.
Poor guy.
Yeah. Poor guy.
Yeah.
Poor guy. So yeah, that was the experience in Hawaii.
Well, then let's talk basketball.
Let's talk basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
UCLA went 1-2.
Yeah, first off, your perspective. There's always a different perspective when you're watching a game. The media was instead of up in a distant box, correct?
Okay,
you were right on top of it.
First, I've got a complaint. My position of mostly watching the games from home is totally correct. It is the absolute, inviolable, like, absolute correct position. I was sitting behind a basket the entire game trying to watch this thing.
Yep.
Both, all three games. So the perspective's different. I mean, and I've known this for many years of doing it, but it's not as easy to, you know, especially like spacing, like where's this guy? Where is he in relation to his defender is much, much harder from that court level, especially from that angle.
Yeah, that's if you're watching the game because you're going to write about it. A lot of the media aren't even watching the game.
No, I've got Seth Davis in front of me just staring at his phone the entire frigging game.
Wait, you buried the lead.
Yeah, my
Seth
boy.
Seth Davis, this is your guy. I mean, you exchange Christmas cards and things together.
Yeah, we're best buds. We're best buds.
Did you say anything to him? Does he know who you are?
No, I wasn't about to do that.
You should have introduced yourself.
No, I didn't want to do that.
Oh, my God. It's just for everyone to know.
I've gotten my Twitter account blocked by Seth and Bro's Twitter.
I think that's the only account Bro's blocked on.
It might be.
Dave got in a Twitter war with Seth Davis.
I've gotten in a couple now. There've been multiple.
I mean, you're just trolling him too.
Yeah, that's the
thing. And he gets sucked right in, and then after a while, he just blocks you.
It's so sad. Anyway, you got that schmuck just like staring at his phone the whole time. Anyway, the first couple of games, UCLA was on the far bench. The last game, they were on the near bench. But yeah, I mean, it was an interesting perspective. Hearing the UCLA bench up close, Mick was on one, especially against Gonzaga, which drew some. I don't know. Was that obvious on TV how much of one he was on?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different facets to Mick's sideline. There's during, you know, there's his actual walking up and down the sideline during a game or even at a dead ball, and he's yelling at the refs or he's yelling at his players in a position. And then there's the timeouts.
Oh, yeah.
The telecast showed him throw one of the chairs that, you know, they bring out the chairs and he just kind of shoved it, I'd say.
Yeah.
They showed that twice.
That's not good.
No. And then the rest of the rants on the sideline. That was it. They didn't get in too deeply to the timeout.
This was the most. So again, there's the caveat that I mostly am watching from TV. This was the most I had seen, like the probably the most intense he's been during a game. And I'd heard pregame that like he really, really wanted this one. Like this was one that he'd spent all night game planning, and he'd kind of like the team was walking out of like the pregame scout with like wide eyes, like, wow, you know, we've really got to get this one. So I think that kind of maybe had a role in it too, but really, really intense. And like the collected media, but also like just like the huge swaths of fan sections right behind and around the UCLA bench were all like, you could hear them muttering after, cause they would go into a timeout and he'd be like screaming at a Dem or screaming at Dylan or something. And everyone would be like, wow. He's going after him. I didn't think I'd need earplugs for the timeouts. I don't know. I mean, we've talked about it before. I generally think you can get your point across without, you know, going to those lengths. I realize different styles, especially with coaching and in basketball, guys are used to it because there's at all levels of college basketball, well, at all levels of basketball coaching going down to youth leagues. You've got coaches who are screamers and coaches who are not. I just generally, it's not my preferred style.
Yeah, you know, it's a good thing for us to talk about. I think, I, for me, not preferred either, but Mick's version of it is obviously successful. There are, for whatever reason, there are coaches who can get very intense and scream, and it doesn't work. We know it. His works for whatever reason it works. So I say there's that. The other thing is it's not for everyone. And we've always told, you know, that's been our day one message when Mick Cronin got the job. The program is not going to be for everyone. Generally, it will, you know, weed out those who don't want to come. And those are the ones who look at this and say, I don't want any part of that, are the ones that wouldn't work with well within the program and probably be successful anyway, working for them. So it's a self-screening, you know, process, and that's part of it. I think it's always, there's a different element to it here, and let's just talk about it because it's interesting. There are, when you recruit American prospects, they kind of know who Mick Cronin is, at least more so. Right?
Yeah.
Then if you're international, I think the international guys are going through a little bit of a process of realizing, and they got it in practice. It wasn't like this was the first time. It might have been a little stunning that it was, that they're starting to get used to it at a game. And like you said, against Gonzaga, because it was pretty intense for Gonzaga. And I just have to say too, from what I've heard, Cronin was working on it last season, and I thought he got a little bit better. But I think you're right. He really wanted this. He wanted this win. That combined with the inexperience of the team created that little environment.
Yeah, and I would say the previous two games, we were further away, but it was I would say, normal level Cronin. This past one I thought was high level Cronin. It was 99th percentile Cronin. Anyway, that's all about soft stuff. The games themselves, I would say from an atmosphere perspective, Marquette UCLA was NCAA tournament, like later round level. Like the intensity, the volume of the fan bases, like everything about the atmosphere felt like, wow, this is a really, really high level game. Gonzaga was not that. UCLA Gonzaga was an absolutely listless, god awful basketball game, made so entirely by the refs. Now, I will say, if the refs had not been so bad, I'm not sure UCLA would have been in the game long enough to finally make that run at the end. I thought Mick Cronin had a...
Well, not only that, I made that point, that they stayed in the game because they shot so many free throws.
Yeah, it was all the fouls actually keeping them in.
Yeah.
But Mick's impression of the game that they started playing hard after whatever it was, like 8 minutes or whatever, I didn't think they started playing really hard until the final 8 minutes of the game. They were kept in it largely by the free throw line. And at the end of the game, essentially, they found, you know, hey, this Alon guy, he can really play.
I think there were three layers, because the first 7 to 8 minutes, really, they looked shell-shocked or stunned. And I wrote about it. I think they played Marquette. Marquette is a perimeter-oriented game. And you tell me, watching that game, they set screens, but they don't really set tough physical screens. And then Chaminade was a complete perimeter game. Gonzaga has a rep, and I saw it in this game too. They punch you, they pull you, they grab you, they push you. It's what they do. And I think just the whole experience of being there, playing three games in a row, and then suddenly getting pushed and pulled and everything, they were shell-shocked. So there's that level. Then they intensified for a portion of the game, and then they really turned it up in the last 6-7 minutes.
Yeah, I think we're speaking the same language.
Yeah, I just wanted to get that little thing in about Gonzaga.
Gonzaga.
Sorry. Never gonna let that
but,
one go.
Yeah, so it was, I just thought from observing the game standpoint, I thought Marquette UCLA was just a much, much better game. Gonzaga ended up being close, but it was, you know, miserable. And then from like, I guess my overarching impression of this team.
Well, first off, wait, let's just talk. Have you? I've never seen anything like that from a referee standpoint. There was a foul called every 47 seconds in that game.
Yeah, I mean it was the worst officiated game I've ever seen. Just to add a personal element, I had to catch a direct flight out of Honolulu that night, and them making it the longest game of the Maui Invitational by about 25 minutes was insane. I was like telling everyone pregame, I'm like, oh, it'll be fine because it's going to be a 2-hour game. We'll do interviews and all that kind of stuff. Instead, I was just sweating bullets the entire time because the first half took an hour. They called 29 fouls, so it took an hour. Then it was halftime, and then the second half took another hour because they called 22 more fouls. Insane, Tracy. Insane.
Adai Mara played 3 minutes. He had 3 fouls.
Yep.
Ken Wuba fouled out
in 14 minutes.
While then Adem Bona, Burke, everyone's piling up fouls. They all were in foul trouble the entire game. It was insane. And I know that's a physical game between Gonzaga and UCLA, but you just can't. I think Mark Few said he respected the ref's call that they were trying to get it under control. Well, they didn't succeed.
No.
Yeah.
No, and they were calling. I mean, it was really capricious, but I would say like it was. I mean, the post stuff was relatively consistent. It's just you couldn't play in the post. Like, that's what they were basically telling the teams. You can't post up. And if a guy posts up, you actually can't touch him either. You just can't play in the paint. I think through the first 3 minutes of the game, there were 8 fouls all on the post players for both teams. It was insane.
Yeah. And just to also say, worst 3 officiated games in a row that I think I've watched.
Marquette was really bad too.
Wow, that was more Marquette of the like bad.
This is just capricious and stupid. But yeah, they were really bad.
Okay.
Anyway, all right. So overall impression of the team from the 3 games, from my perspective, is I think we got a lot more information. I think generally speaking, I'm higher on them coming out than I was going in. I think the upside is there, and I think it's you can see how to hit it. I do think there's some come to Jesus stuff that I think Mick Cronin has to arrive at. That I think that's going to be the harder piece, and it's not quite like Prince Ali 2019-2020 level, but there are some things that he has to realize and stop doing or accentuate differently. That we all got information from this game, but from these 3 games, but it's now going to be how does the person who actually matters utilize that information?
Yeah. I came away too, like you said, we have a lot more information, and that's how I wrote that story. A lot more to go on. My impression was, first off, the biggest takeaway for me, and this is combined, just not those 3 games, but the 6 games that they played completely now. Mick Cronin, the vital component for him to be able to coach a team and for that team to be even marginally successful is if they're going to play hard and be relatively tough. My one takeaway, biggest takeaway, was that I think that's you check that box. They're a mess on defense in a lot of ways, but for the most part, for a team made up of a lot of freshmen and a lot of young guys, they're playing hard. They have some letdowns where they look fatigued. Dylan Andrews looked tired against Gonzaga to me. And understandably so. I mean, playing point guard for 3 straight games will tire you out. But I'm more impressed than I even... I think there's always a roll of the dice that these you're going to get guys who are going to play hard and be tough and be tough-minded. And I think he has the potential for this team to live up to that this year. Without it, it's just not going to happen, right? Mick Cronin will make it, will want it to happen, but if you don't have those guys, it's not going to happen. And he's going through the process right now of trying to discover who those guys are. My second biggest takeaway was Alon Fabloy. I think he didn't play extended minutes, but when he was in there, he showed he's a Mick Cronin kind of guy. What I liked about him particularly, he seems so even keeled. Like nothing's, he just comes in, he plays at the same level. He comes in, the team's better on both sides of the court. He does little things. It's so weird because he's not Jalen Clark. He doesn't, there's so many things different between him and Jalen Clark, but there are so many things that are similar. And one of the biggest similarities is, remember when you'd insert Jalen Clark, the team immediately got better.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew this when he was a junior, but we didn't know about it when he was a freshman or sophomore. We were just starting to learn. And remember, we became Jalen Clark Report Online. And they'd insert him in the game. The team just started playing better. And you'd go, wait, let me go look. Yeah, that's when they started playing better, when Jalen Clark came in. That's how Fleblois is for me. It's the same effect. Well, and if he doesn't start, he's got this, my feeling, he's got to be the first off the bench, like Jalen Clark was. He's their sixth man.
Yeah, and this is the part where I think it's the Jalen Clark comparison is apt. And some people, were saying before, I think somebody posted on the board, oh, maybe he'll have his Jaime Jaquez freshman year opening moment. And I think Ben said something similar in his, he tweeted after the game about, Alon emerged in Maui just like Jaime Jaquez. And I'm like, yeah, but Mick's not going to see Alon the same way he saw Jaime because he doesn't have the offensive skill. And so Alon's going to be more in that Jalen Clark bucket, where I think his minutes this year are going to be interesting to observe. So right now, just so everyone knows, a statistical perspective, and this is all very early, but he leads the team in box score plus minus right now. That's the stat that Jalen Clark was always like way, way off the charts because they contribute in so many different ways, but it's a statistical measure. So you're getting a lot of, blocks and steals in there, but he's doing all of that stuff and that stuff matters. I would say that's one of the personnel standouts. I think he's got to be, if I were the basketball coach, I'd probably just start him. But I'm with you, at least at the very least off the bench. And
if you were the basketball coach, would you shave your beard or would you just go like bushier?
I would go even bushier.
The one other thing I want to say, I think that, and I'm not blaming Cronin because it's this would have been a little bit out of the box thinking, slightly. Antoine Watson just lit up UCLA. 14 of 15 shooting, scored 32 points, hit all three of his threes. He had been 1 for 5 from three before that, and he probably hit all three because he was wide open. They let him shoot. I would have loved to have seen Fabloy on him early and play 28 minutes, basically defending. And you take Antoine Watson, he scores, a reasonable 17 points, 18. UCLA wins this game.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things like, but
so I'm cherry picking. I get it. I would have liked to have seen that.
That goes to my other elephant in the room, my very long, tall giraffe in the room. This is the part where I think the discordance between what observers are seeing and what actually happens on the court is probably going to be the most profound, is Adai Mara. This week I thought was pretty eye-opening, which they started, so Adem and Adai started alongside each other against Chaminade and against Gonzaga, and Adai was obviously ineffective against Gonzaga, 3 fouls in 3 minutes, but even against Chaminade wasn't particularly effective, and didn't play much of the second half. Each time it contributed to, some issues defensively. I think this is the piece that, so against Gonzaga, they did something very, very interesting, which was not only did they go a Dem and a Dye to start the game, but then because of a Dye's foul trouble, the first player off the bench ended up being Kenneth Nuba.
Yeah.
And if you're finding yourself in a position where you are so committed to the big that you're bringing in Nuba that's the first player off the bench, I just think you got to go back to the drawing board. And especially in that lineup, because I think the idea was we're going to advantage ourselves against this Gonzaga lineup because we're going to have more size, we're going to have more strength than they do, and that's going to give us an advantage on the interior. The only problem is none of these guys have been an advantage on the interior, and I'm including a Dem, certainly Nuba, but also a Dye, and none of them have been playing very good defense. Nuba's probably been the best.
Nuba's probably been the best pure post player this year so far. Yeah. On both sides of the court.
Adem's out of control. He's trying to do way too much on both sides. Like, he's trying to do way too much offensively. He's taken, you know, the jumpers and all that kind of stuff. But on defense, he's trying to do way too much. It feels like he's constantly running around between the key and the perimeter. So he's not even, we're not even getting the advantage of his rim protection. Like, that's not even happening. So, I think the other piece of information, and this is the part that I think is going to take the longest to get there, is this team may in some absolutely unknowable future be okay at playing big, and I mean true big, center, may be okay at doing that at some point in the deep and distant future, but I'm talking deep and distant, like, probably not this year. I don't know if Adai Mara is going to be, you know, we talked about it preseason where, oh, maybe he can play 20 minutes a game. He's so far from that right now that it's hard to imagine it. But
right. I think you're nails here. And I think the thing that might naturally solve this issue, and what you said, Adai Mara goes out, Ken Nuba comes in. So Cronin's still trying to run the two big offense.
Right.
That's an indication that he wants to make this work because they've spent so much time on it in practice. He wants to make it work. The difference will be, I think, is that Berke Büyükçekmece is going to emerge as... He played his first three games. His first three games he's actually played in, I don't know, 6 months. You can tell it's there.
Yeah.
The height, the skill. And what was most impressive, especially when he started against Marquette, was his, because Marquette was one guy who's 6'8", and then a bunch of perimeter guys. He could move his feet and defend.
Yep.
By the time Gonzaga came around. He was a little fatigued. But I think the fact that Cronin started him against Marquette is recognition that this guy is one of my top five players. I'm going to have to get him on the court. He didn't play like that during those three games, but he flashed what he's going to be. So what I think it will naturally shake out that Berkey's going to be playing. He's going to have to play. And if you put him in with the Dem, you're not going to play that two big offense, right?
Right.
It's going to be the one in, four out. Also because, I mean, Berkey's not a true five. He's a face-up four, and he'll be able to defend college fours. So... Yeah. When he is in, have you watched the offense when he's in? They go between the two big and the one in, four out.
Yeah, it improves spacing because he is actually a semi threat from the perimeter, even acknowledging his horrible air ball against Chaminade. He's an actual threat from the perimeter, so he draws respect, he draws bodies,
But even when they're doing the two big with him in it, it improves spacing.
Yeah.
Because I think he's got a better feel for it. He knows how to play that kind of offense. He's a really good passer, which he showed this weekend too. So I think he naturally is going to solve this problem. And then, as you said, they will eventually do a couple of things by the end of the season. Adaimara will come in when Berke is playing the four, or maybe Alon Fablois is playing the four. And then maybe they will occasionally have Mara and Bona in together for that two big. But I think by the time, like you said, by the end of the year, I think we naturally might not be seeing that as much. And I think it's all because it's going to happen because of Berke.
Yeah. And well, I would say for Mara, I would say he's having a real tough time dealing with the strength of the players he's going against. And he's getting stripped. He just looks a little bit, he looks rattled, but he also just doesn't look strong enough. And I think that's one of the biggest limitations, is you can't have him doing the high post stuff that you thought you might be able to have him do against high major opponents, because he's just going to get stripped over and over and over again, because he keeps bringing the ball low, because he can't hold on to it long enough, because he doesn't hold it high, he doesn't hold it confidently. And so all that stuff where we were talking about, oh, you can have him in the high post and have him lob it to Bona for a dunk just over and over again, he can't do it because he'll draw a double and he'll panic. And that stuff will improve a little bit from a feel perspective, but some of the strength stuff, I don't know how much you can do that in season.
That's why I think he's going to be the most effective when he works to post up on the block, deep in the paint, get him the ball, and that's when, and just keep the ball high, nice, don't put it on the floor, just turn over. He can go off of each shoulder. I mean, he's that good. And let him score within, 7 feet. Let him do that.
Yeah, it's going to be...
And he's a great passer out of that, too. I watched enough games. He's a very good passer out of that low block post.
It's going to take some time. Yeah, but I think at this point, for me, I think what this team will grow into, and what I would like to see, is probably, like you said, Berke at the four. They did a little bit of it, and I think this is going to have to be, if they want to hit their upside, having him do some small ball backup five behind Bona. Whenever Mara gets ready, you can obviously have him be, 15 minutes at the five, but until then, have Berke do the backup five stuff. And I'm talking against good opponents. Experiment however you want against UC Riverside. But once you get back to playing Ohio State and Maryland and stuff. And then your 4 minutes, I think it's really simple. After Berke moves to the five or moves to the bench, it's Alon and Lazar. Lazar has... What is my dude Lazar rebounding at right now? Because it's something insane.
7 rebounds a game, I think it is.
Yeah,
he's right behind Bona.
Yeah, his defensive rebounding rate is second on the team among guys who've actually played considerable minutes.
And his offensive rebounding has been
a
huge factor. When he flies, he did it. I mean, he got a lot of offensive rebounds. There was two during the course of three games where he flew into the paint, ripped a ball away from a lot of tall guys, came down, held on. I mean, it looked like a Superman move. He's playing his ass off too. So yeah, the rebounding is a big thing. Sorry to cut you off, but I'll just finish on him. He is a good offensive player. He can't create on his own. He can take two dribbles, pull up if he's got space. He's a good mid-range shooter. We've seen when they run something for him on inbounds and it's automatic. Run a couple of screens, a couple of staggered screens. He comes around, catches, and it's nails. They gotta start doing that stuff like in the half court offense for him. But right now, that's a second or third. Remember Johnny Juzang?
Yeah.
They ran that whole offense to get him an open look. The entire offense was, now they're running an offense, a high low two big offense, the handoff thing, the turn look down. For the other, and it's we need a little bit more of the Johnny Juzang offense for Stefanovic.
What we're getting a lot of is the let Adem Bona cook offense, and Adem Bona can't cook. Adem Bona should be, I don't know, right now, that starting group. Let's say Stefanovic should be the number one option or number two. Max should be vice versa. Dylan Andrews probably number three. I would put Adembona as your fourth option offensively. Basically, if open for a lob or a dunk, or if he has a small guy on him.
Yeah, that's it. It's all about matchups.
Yes. Or if it's an obvious single matchup where they're not going to be able to bring a double easily. But if he can be doubled, you really shouldn't throw it to him because he's struggling really hard with decisions out of doubles. And he'll then kind of mechanically try to go up, won't be able to, get stripped. I mean, he dropped a couple of balls. I think his hands just generally aren't, they're not spectacular hands. And so he can be stripped. He can drop the ball, can just kind of fumble it a little bit. When he can go up and do that little right-handed semi-jump hook, it's more or less like a push shot because he turns his body fully towards the hoop and shoots it. But when he can do that from like 6 feet, 8 feet, he's okay. And when he can dunk, he's great. But I think treating him like what he was last year, where he was more or less a rim runner, is probably the more effective move. I think this, you know, we're going to let him make decisions in the low post. Good for his development, maybe, but I don't think it's good for the success of this team this year.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Yeah, completely agree. Adembona, you know I'm an Adem. I've got a little
bit. I love Adembona.
Yeah, I love Adembona. When you, if you ever get a chance to be around him within like 6 feet, just sit there and like you're feeling the rays of the sun.
Oh, we're getting weird again. Let's go for it.
But he's just still really raw. He's not the offensive player that's being assumed right now. And it's not good when he does it against mid-majors because that only builds overconfidence that he can get it done against high majors. He hasn't been able to. Will he get better? Yeah, I'm sure they're going to try to settle him down in the post. But remember last year, this is what's interesting too about last year. He passed really well out of the post because in his mind, he wasn't the scorer. He was looking for the other options on the team. So he found them as a good passer. Now he's so concerned with scoring because he's been told he's the scorer. He's not even looking to pass. When he gets doubled, we've seen it. He's a good passer for a post player. He should be looking around to pass the ball. So he'll get better. What we're kind of saying is we hope it gets off that track, though, that the objective of the offense is not that Adembona is the number one option.
Yeah. And the other piece of information for me that was interesting was Sebastian Mack. Because I think, so there's a little bit of, I don't know, eye of the beholder stuff going on. But like, you kind of see in Mack whatever you want to see. because you can see absolutely a selfish shot hunting player, right? You can see like somebody, I'm not going to name names, posited a Jalen Hands comparison, which I thought was borderline an act of violence, maybe a crime in certain jurisdictions, but okay. But you can see that a little bit. But on the other hand, I see, first a driver like they haven't had. Honestly, I don't remember the last time UCLA, certainly not Mick Cronin, but I don't remember the time UCLA had a guy who could drive the way he can. Quick first step, get to the rim. Pretty much any time he's got a guy on him who's not NBA level quickness. Like, he's going to get to the rim. So that's one. And two, somebody who can finish pretty well at the rim for layups.
And he doesn't even have, he can't get off the floor. No, he doesn't have a lot of spring. It's just he's so strong.
Yes.
And his shoulders are wide that he
body control.
Body control and carve enough space to be able to finish.
Yeah, it's an element of an offense that has been lacking in the Cronin era. And I think people are not they're putting him in a bucket rather than recognizing the unique part of what he does. And the thing with that is, that's not something you want going away at all. That's something you need to refine. But I think that's the other piece of this team that's really, really intriguing from an upside perspective, is they haven't had a guard like that. Like, they really haven't. Tiger Campbell was not that. David Singleton certainly wasn't that. Johnny Juzang wasn't that. Jules Bernard wasn't even really that. Big physical, but he didn't have that kind of quick first step where he's going to beat a guy pretty much every time he takes him off the bounce. That's a piece that I think that's the part, honestly, that made me kind of excited about the upside of this team this year, because if he can get refined, and this is the part that's a problem, is he's already, you know, clearly Cronin's crunch time toy. Like, he was giving him the ball to make things happen at the end game against Marquette.
Yeah, but I think that play was drawn up as a kick out to Dylan Andrews.
Yeah. But already Cronin's respecting his driving ability enough to know that the other team is going to respect it enough that he'll be able to get an open shot for Dylan Andrews off that play.
Yep.
But I guess you're going to have to refine him in some way, and it's hard to do that when he's already maybe your best guard option on offense, and you know that. But they got to use the bench to teach him. They got to use all those teaching tools. But there's something really, really cool there if they can kind of carve away some of the bits that aren't so great. Because there was a lot in that Gonzaga game where he would drive into the chest of a defender, not draw a foul, and then he didn't have anything to do. If they can just teach him, if there is a defender who is literally going to, you know, give you his chest, you have to kick it out, because that means that was a double where a guy switched over.
It made sense in that game, though, because there were foul called every 47 seconds. I'm going to go run into this guy's chest. I should get a damn call.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the stunning thing about those two games is I think Mac shot 14 free throws against Marquette in a much, I won't say a better officiated game, but a differently officiated game, but only 9 against Gonzaga, and he did no less driving.
So if you throw Dylan Andrews and Sebastian Mack into a big mixing bowl, I think you have all the elements you need for a great backcourt.
Yeah.
They're not the traditional, here's all the point guard, and that's Dylan Andrews, here are all those traits, and then here's the shooting guard. But they fulfill all of those on both sides of the court, on offense and defense.
Yep.
They've got to figure that out.
Yeah.
There is an offense here where Sebastian Mack drives and he kicks it out to either Stefanovic or Dylan Andrews, and they're going to be, at least for a while, defenses are going to just sag and leave those guys open. And if you leave both those guys open, they're going to shoot at a 36% clip, at least from three. Dylan Andrews is a good shooter. he's not getting too many open looks. When he gets an open look, he hits it. It's because he's got a guy who's, you know, on ball defending him. He's not getting, he needs the ball kicked to him when the defense is going some other direction.
Yeah.
That's usually the shooting guard sometimes. I mean, let's not even define it. There's the makings of a really good backcourt there, along with Stefanovic. It's going to be about drawing the defense to collapse and kickouts. So much of that, and like I said, running some screens for Stefanovic. What we're kind of saying is, at this point, and it really seized up in your mind against Gonzaga. You're 7-8 minutes into Gonzaga and you're all, how's this team going to score? The only way to score is if Sebastian Mack drives and is fouled and goes to the line. I mean, without Adembona as a go-to in the middle, if Adeyemara brings anything to the court, is if he catches it in the block, he's got a good chance that he's going to score the ball. But take that away, and this is an offense which is trying to get the ball down into the post and isn't running really anything for its perimeter players. If that happens, there's no offense. This offense has to start emphasizing drives and kickouts or feeds into the post and then passing out of that to open shooters. And I think at least for a while, opposing teams are going to let that happen. If they do a scout on UCLA, they're going to say, they're trying to get the ball inside of those guys. We need to collapse on them. Dylan Andrews right now is shooting 22% from three. If someone looks at that, does a scout on them, they're going, oh, let's let him shoot. Right.
Yeah.
It's funny. You've kind of set up your upcoming opponents right now. In a good way, because you've been running this post-first offense. And Sebastian Mack, here's where he really needs to develop. He needs to because right now when he's driving, his head is down and he's going to that basket and either scoring or getting fouled. He's got to be looking for a kickout. He's got to be looking for someone open. That's going to be the big development for him. That decision-making when he's driving.
Yeah, and they need to have shooters on the wing when he's in. But I think there's a lot of upside just with him and with that ability. When you can drive like that, it opens up an offense. So I don't know. There was a lot of really good stuff, but I think we're in agreement fully on Alon, Berke's potential, and then
To mention about Alon too. He doesn't look like he shoots the ball really well, and it's a long shot, takes a while to get off, and he's only taken two, but he's hit one three. By the end of practice, meaning right before the season was going to start, he had snuck up on it to the point where he was one of the best three-point shooters on the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if he can get comfortable doing that and shoot 34% from three, given everything else he does, he's got to play 25 minutes.
Yeah, they got to get him a lot more minutes. Yeah. And that's just, I think that's the one that I think is going to drive everyone crazy if he's back to like 5 to 10 minutes.
And then the other thing to look for was Berke, did he play in the second half like a minute or two?
I think he played in the second half. Let me pull up the stats. I've got them in front of me. He played 3 minutes in the second half.
And Mick Cronin in postgame, and I get this, he said, I'm looking for the guys I need to win a game. And I'm hoping that Berke is under that umbrella.
I mean, he played Brandon Williams 6 minutes, so I don't know. I think Mick was, sometimes like the things Mick focuses on in a game are startling to me. And I'm just like, huh. Okay, well, fine. I mean, you've won a lot more basketball games coaching than I have. But it's...
wait, someone's got to quote that.
But, like, Brandon Williams, he said after the game, oh, he was pretty... He gave us a nice lift when he was in or something like that. And I'm like, huh.
They love Brandon Williams.
I like Brandon Williams.
It's that East Coast thing, though. They're seeing that East Coast gritty kid.
Yeah, that's the kind of stupid stuff I don't love. Because, sure, nobody from a place is tougher because they're from a place.
That's just my guess. Okay. Yeah.
Berke's got that gritty Istanbul thing.
The mean streets of Istanbul.
Yeah, the mean streets of Istanbul. Anyway, there's a lot to work out here. It's a fun little project. I think everything we said preseason still holds. There's going to be ups and downs. It's going to look
weird. Even more
so.
Like I wrote, the floor is higher coming out of this. I said they'd be 4-2. They're 4-2. They've won and lost each game that we predicted. It wasn't hard. It's not a big boast.
Right.
But I'd say the floor is higher mostly because of that they are a team that generally has played hard and been pretty tough so far, all in all.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. So we will see how this shakes out. All right, we gotta switch gears, Tracy.
Yeah.
All right, we're switching gears to football. Football. I feel like what's that line? Generalissimo Francisco Franco, still dead. Chip Kelly, still UCLA's football head coach.
Oh, wow, you're gonna go right in. You're not gonna like pussyfoot around this, are you?
No, I don't pussyfoot.
Yeah, I know. I don't. You're not a pussyfooter.
I don't believe in pussyfooting, Tracy.
Let's first just start about my report. Everything sure. That happened, just really a fast. Yes, I 100% am confident what I reported was accurate. In my history of doing this job, it was on the very high side of reliable sources, a very big number of reliable sources telling me this. And what they told me, it was likely Chip Kelly would get fired. Dave, you heard from your sources independent of mine. Correct?
Yeah, it's people who are in the actually never wrong category.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, yeah, that's true. Sure.
Yeah. So, do things change? Yes. And I know people say I'm using the fluid thing, but guys, if you want to be taken behind the curtain and you want to know the whole process here, this is what's going to happen. Things change. Things obviously changed, and honestly, I think the report changed things also. I think there are people at UCLA that want to control the narrative, and they had lost the narrative with that report. So there's that about that. They beat USC, obviously, and you got it. That was a fun game to watch, though. I got to tell you, when you get those two colors out on that field... The thing, the good one too was that just was kind of chills was the scoop and score. That was just too much. And it's Alex Johnson. I really like Alex Johnson. The walk on, he's not a walk on playing because, you know, Chip Kelly's got some weird affection for walk ons and he kind of, you know, doesn't. Alex Johnson might be their best not Kamari Ramsey, but he legitimately should be playing. So that was all good to see. So yeah, that game was fun. But as Dave, I'm sure we'll elaborate on, that doesn't change the situation.
No.
Okay. Here
that UCLA is deciding to, and maybe, I don't know, whatever, who knows what happens in the next couple weeks, but that UCLA is apparently deciding not to do the obvious, and the obvious being, of course, moving on to a new coaching era, however you want to get that done, whether you want to do it with a firing, is well, it's bad. It's not good. It's not good decision making. And that's just, look, you can get scared off by Bruce Feldman reporting a thing or Joel Klatt saying a thing or Casey Wasserman coming in and saying a thing. But the reality is that this regime is failed. And okay, they're more than likely going to finish this year 8-4. And they finished last year 9-4. And they finished the previous year 8-4. And you can look at that in one way and you can say, oh, this is pretty good. This is fine. But then you look at it and you say, hey, those were three of the easiest UCLA schedules in history. And they finished with four losses every single year. And then on top of that, next year, it's not going to be the easiest schedule in UCLA history. It's going to be right back to UCLA having what it has historically always had, a pretty hard schedule. How's that going to look? Now, this doesn't take elaborate prediction. This is pretty easy stuff. How is that going to look? Well, look at that defense. Who's going to be lost from that defense? Leatu Latu for sure. Who else? Those Murphy twins wanted to leave after last year. They just didn't have quite the years that they wanted to have to leave for the NFL.
See, so you know what, Dave? Let's not speculate about this because I kind of have information on it, but I'm not comfortable because I don't want to violate
sure,
all these.
Fine.
But let's just say 10 of 11 starters.
A lot of defensive players could be moving on.
Yeah. Not 10, I'm sorry. 8 of 11 starters is what I found, and it was 11 of the top 18 in the rotation.
Right.
Something
so
like that. 11 or 12.
You're going to be replacing a ton of your defense, and you're going to be replacing, you know, a decent chunk of your offense. Let's just say that.
Or not just replacing, upgrading. I mean, you need to go out and up. It's the same thing. It's the same
doesn't,
thing.
Same like, word. All of a piece. You've got to replace talented bodies from an 8-4 team. Okay? And you're going to have to do that with NIL money that doesn't exist. And you're going to have to do that with a coaching staff that has largely eschewed recruiting at the high school level to such a point where you can't really expect instant impact players from that level either. So the combination of all of that is that next year's team is going to be less talented than this one, and it's going to be facing a harder schedule. If you just keep it to those two simple truths, you can arrive at the right conclusion, which is they're going to be much worse next year. They're going to have a much worse record. And Chip Kelly is already on a demonstrable hot seat. And that's not the hot seat of Martin Jarmond or the administration. It's the reliable truth that a fan base is already done with him. And so if you have decided not to fire him, okay, I guess you have the control over that. But what does next year look like with a coach on the hot seat and he's going to be coaching a much worse team?
So
are the optics going to be good?
Yeah.
Are they going to be great? Are you going to enjoy them? Or are they going to be bad? Are there going to be banners being flown from planes? Like, what's it going to look like next year? Because that's the thing that UCLA administration has failed to grasp time and time again, is the timeliness of a firing matters more than you would think. And the optics of extending this beyond the point of reasonability, beyond the point where it's worthwhile to continue, is the point where things get ugly.
And really what it comes down to is everything that you just said as it pertains to finances. We can talk about records, you know, his record, Chip Kelly's record, is it worthy of firing? Is it this? At this, yeah, you know, talk about it forever. But right now, anyone who watches this program has to question the financial way forward for the program. We've told you, and this is not guesswork. This is not speculation. NIL is the most immediate future to college sports, at least college football and college basketball. You need NIL money to get talent. You need talent to win. I mean, are there variables in that? Yeah, better coaching will enhance that. Bad coaching will hurt that, obviously. But you need the talent. You need NIL money. I know that UCLA, the football NIL collective, is struggling to get support for the football program. Did it get a little trickle of a boost after USC? Yes, it did, but nothing significant. So that's the main financial component. The UCLA football program has been the one that traditionally has supported the athletic department. It hasn't in, I don't know how many years, in many years, towards the end of the Mora era, during all of the Chip Kelly era, Chip Kelly's program has not captured the fan base in a way to where the administration is satisfied with how much money they're making from it. It's that simple. You can tie a lot of that into attendance. The attendance has been poor under Chip Kelly. It's funny because you can discuss why. You can talk about that he doesn't promote the program, all of that. But really, it's kind of funny. There's a psychology here. UCLA fans, I think have been beaten down for so long between Carl Durrell, Rick Neuheisel. Then they get a little bit of hope for Jim Mora's first 3 years. And then the last 3 years of Jim Mora. So add up all those years. How many were good are few. And then those to pile on, I don't know if pile on is the right word, the right phrase. Those three first losing seasons under Chip Kelly. There are UCLA fans that pretty much said, I'm done right now with this. You're going to have to win at a significant level for a while to bring me back. And you want to argue, oh, aren't UCLA fans horrible? This is the way it is. Get over it. So this is where we are. The attendance is not going to magically turn around. The way it could turn around, and we've been saying this from the beginning, is if Chip Kelly strung together some 10-win seasons or an 11-win season. That's what he would need to do. Coming off of those three losing seasons and the fact he doesn't promote the program. There's no real way forward for the attendance to turn around if UCLA wins out this year. It's not going to turn around. And here's if UCLA is relying on Big Ten teams on the road coming to the Rose Bowl, and that's what they're relying on as financial viability for this program, that's just sad. That's sad to me that that's, I know it's all about money. It's not about necessarily success. If this team won seven to eight, nine games a year, but it was way in the black when it came to profitability in a way that UCLA administration was really happy about it, they were making a lot of money, there would never be a change of coaching ever. No. Ever. So it's not that, though. It needs this UCLA program where it is now post-COVID with the Rams and the Chargers in town. It needs to win 10 or 11 games a lot of times. It needs to compete for Pac-12 championships. It needs to be competitive in the Big Ten make money.
You can't be gifted the schedules they've been gifted the last 3 years and lose four games every single year. You just can't.
And we're talking now. Let's always think about what Dave's saying right now from a money perspective about making money.
So I think there's a few ways to think about it. And you can either bucket it however you want to do it. Incompetence, ignorance, or cynicism. And so I don't think it's pure incompetence to continue with this era. Leaving me with the two other buckets. One is ignorance. And this is the part where I don't know. Martin Jarmond is new to UCLA still. He's only experienced bad UCLA, right? He's been here since COVID. And this is something that I've kind of seen as a through line with a lot of his comments on attendance, a lot of his commentary on Rose Bowl and all this kind of stuff, is I think he sees what UCLA is doing now midway through the Chip Kelly era post-COVID as the way things will always be with attendance. And the thing is, it wasn't even 10 years ago when I think UCLA was averaging 75,000 a game for Jim Mora in 2014. This is all that it takes. All that it takes is win some real games against good teams, be in the conversation, and be exciting. That's it. And Jim Mora was able to do that. Do you know what Jim Mora is doing at UConn right now? I think they won two games this year. We're not talking about like Nick Saban. You hired the failed Falcons coach, and he was able to accomplish that. So it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't take going and hiring the best coach in history. It just takes hiring somebody who wants to win and has some energy. So that's one. And that's in the ignorance pile, where maybe still just doesn't realize what a good coach could bring in terms of eyeballs on the program, in terms of interest in the program, in terms of actual dollars, like all that kind of stuff. And then there's the cynical bucket, which is UCLA is going to the Big Ten next year. Do you know what that's going to include? A huge financial windfall. That financial windfall is all those TV dollars. Now, we've been positing the hopeful scenario with what UCLA will do with that money, which is reinvest it in the program, make it even better, make it more, you know, able to win and all that kind of stuff. The cynical angle is, what can that money also do? It can inure you from your fan base. It can make it so that you don't have to feel pressure to change because you don't really need butts in the seats as much. You can just cash that money, have it fund your other athletic programs, take your, you know, seven losses a year and call it a day. And that's another angle that some schools have actually chosen, that angle, Rutgers being one. There's a lot of choices on the immediate horizon that I don't think UCLA fans are necessarily contending with, that going into the Big Ten right now with a regime that is not poised for success is going to lead to some weird stuff in the next year or two. The records are probably not going to be very good, but what's gone on in the last week and a half to kind of shift this momentum is not a great insight into the decision making there.
And if this all plays out like what you're saying, Dave, it's really, if you take the real big picture, we were talking about it a couple of days ago. How many wins? Let's just say this is, you know, we're speculating a lot, but given how the transfer portal will be, you said it not too long ago, a few minutes ago, UCLA will probably be, the team will probably be about as good as it is this year. Defense won't be as good. Offense will probably be a little bit better. And that's just, we're not going to get into how we came upon that from player to player, but, you know, speculating who's going to stay, who's going to leave, the chances of them replacing some talent through the transfer portal. That team, like you said, Dave, what's its record in the Big Ten next year?
All right, so just to eyeball it, so they have to go at Hawaii, they'll win that. Indiana at home, they'll win that. At LSU, they'll lose that. Oregon, they'll lose that. At Penn State, they'll lose that.
2-3.
Minnesota at home, probably win that. Mm-hmm. At Rutgers and at Nebraska, let's just go 1-1 through that. So that's 4-4.
4-4.
Iowa at home.
Wow. That's tough. Let's say let's leave that.
Four. Yeah. Okay. At Washington, 5-5. USC at home.
Well, if they get a good defensive coordinator.
Let's just go this. USC and Fresno State, home and home. Let's go 1-1 through that. Six and six.
So given what we just laid out, the possible mentalities, well, let's say it's 6-6. Do they keep riding with that?
Oh, but Tracy, you know, because it's 1.500 year. That's not so bad.
Well, and also think what they're thinking about. Attendance, the Rose Bowl. Give me those home games again.
Indiana, Oregon, Minnesota.
Okay, Iowa. First off, Indiana fans will probably show up just to come out to the Rose Bowl for the fun of it. Oregon fans show up everywhere when you have an elite program, and they're Oregon fans. Iowa fans will flood Pasadena. Who else?
Minnesota.
Oh yeah. What date is that?
October 12th.
Yeah, you want to get out of Minnesota on October 12th. Okay.
And then USC and Fresno State.
Okay. You know what? It's not like Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan fans coming to the Rose Bowl. So the attendance will be just okay, better. It'll be better than it was this year by far.
Well, because it's actual high major opponents every game except for Fresno State.
Right. So do they just say 6-6, but the attendance was better? We're making some money. We got some money now from the Big Ten. Do we just keep riding with 6-6?
Yeah, 6-6 in a bowl game, baby. That's dark.
That's dark. We cannot end it with that.
Okay, UCLA, they're playing Cal this weekend. Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about the Cal game. I forgot about that game.
The sturdy Golden Bear, they're going after 6 wins. UCLA is going after 8. Cal's obviously got some motivation advantage going into the game because they're actually playing for something. UCLA's playing for, I think, the opportunity to be more firmly ensconced in the Los Angeles Bowl. I'm not sure. Doesn't really matter.
What date's the Los Angeles Bowl? It's like the 16th?
December 16th. It's not the one you want if you actually recruit. If you're a recruiting program,
but Las Vegas Bowl, those are the two chances, right? Really?
Well, yeah, because they won't get the Sun Bowl again. So basically, it's three teams: Utah, USC, and UCLA competing for the Vegas, Sun, and LA Bowl. Sun Bowl just took UCLA, so they won't take them again. So it really comes down to, I think Vegas is going to want Utah more than anybody else, and I think they're going to get them. And so then it's USC to the Sun Bowl and UCLA to the Los Angeles Bowl.
Okay.
Anyway, so Cal. Here's my read on Cal. They're a bad team. They've got a pretty decent offense. Their defense is horrible. They've shown signs of life with Fernando Mendoza at quarterback. Their running game is pretty good. Jaden Ott's pretty good. UCLA, if they play well, should beat them pretty good. That's about it.
Yeah, the matchups all favor UCLA. Cal's few little strengths on offense, you can just see UCLA's defense just snuffing those out.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, I mean, Cal's defense ain't good.
No.
Just not good. UCLA will probably be able to run the ball against them, you would suspect, but probably look to be even more balanced. Have the ability to be a little bit more balanced. I think Cal's passing defense is just about the best thing it does.
Yeah.
UCLA should clearly win this game. Clearly. And, you know, let's bring in all the UCLA fans so we can all just join hands. It's the last game of this season. It's senior night. You give senior day, senior night. It's at 7:30, right, the game?
Yes.
So it's a good tribute to all those UCLA players that have been giving so much of their time, effort, life to the UCLA program. So that's all good to send them out with a win. But other than that, just kind of how much interest is there in this game? See, getting back to what we were saying, how much interest, how many people will be at this game? Who among you out there, you are all the diehard UCLA fans, have high interest in this game? Okay, I'm going back dark.
I heard a tumbleweed.
We were supposed to go high. Okay, so UCLA is going to win this game.
Yeah.
They're going to beat down Cal in its last game within the Pac-12.
They're going to beat them good.
Yeah, they're going to get revenge for the Calamony.
Yes, it's going to be just a resounding victory. And everyone will be excited. There will be joy in Mudville.
And the basketball team plays on the 9th.
Hey!
Right?
30th.
Oh, the 30th. Sorry. I skipped over.
You skipped over something. I think it was UC Riverside, so it's fine.
That's why.
All right. Well, that's exciting. Great.
You're laughing you do that. It's that dog. That cartoon dog. Remember we talked about it before?
Yes, we did. All right.
I can't do it like you.
That's
beautiful
all,
stuff.
That's all we
I
have.
Hope you're all having a great weekend, though. Holiday
Happy
weekend.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Black Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, for Tracy Pearson, I'm David Woods. Bruin Report Online. We'll talk to you again next time.
See y'all.
This is Tony Kornheiser's show. I'm Tony. We expected someone else. So what exactly is the show about?
I don't know.
It's a sports show nominally. Football's over, but we're finally at a point where things matter in college basketball, and baseball season is on deck. Greatest three words in the English language, pitchers and catchers. We have some of the best voices come on and explain what matters or what makes an upset, like Ryan does, 9-8. No, that's not an upset. No, yeah, it is, Bob. And if you're lucky, I might just tell you about my search for discounted sleep pants or my worries about what my dog just ate. Listen on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.